I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
In today's episode of Project Recovery,
I would take 7-8 pills a day of Lorotab. I would take 4-5 Xanax.
Wow.
And then my Adderall.
You must have just been in sort of a fog all
pretty
the time.
Pretty much.
Right? Because,
well, makes,
I mean, that's...
The day sound like a yo-yo. Up and down, up and down, up and down.
I wanted to because I, at that point, and I know it sounds like an excuse, but at that point I hadn't gotten over finding my dad.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovering. It's brought to you by our friends at knowyourscript.org. They say know your script when talking to yourself, talking to your doctor, talking to your family, and knowing actually what's on the bottle when you are ingesting what they're giving you. And the onus is a little bit about on you, right, Dr. Matt?
Definitely. In fact, I was going to make a talking to yourself joke, but the reality is we all do talk to ourselves. We have internal dialogue. And part of that has, you know, part of your internal dialogue ought to be empowering. I think that's what their campaign is to empower each of us to know the questions to ask and have the courage to ask the questions and have the conversation with our kids. If you can educate yourself and your kids on the medicine, whew, that's a huge one. No fault of my parents, but I don't remember them talking to me about the medications we took. We just took what the doctor prescribed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the old way of doing things, and that's gotten us all in a little bit of trouble.
You know, you said having a dialogue with yourself or talking to yourself. When I was giving it everything I had in TV and in radio and in my early 20s and 30s, anything that was before me, I'd say, I got this. And I would go for it. And yeah. The self-talk and the self-dialogue was positive. It was, yes, you can do this. Why can't you? You know, my philosophy is always, someone's going to have to win the lottery. Why not me? You know what I mean? It was that kind of mentality. It's like, well, somebody's got to do it, so I'm going to give it a shot. I just might actually get it.
Yeah. My grandpa, one of the few bits of advice he gave me was, he said, well, I just say, if someone else can do it, I can do it too. So having that confidence that you're the person who can step up and make a difference, that gets us a lot farther than we think in life.
Now, let me tell you this. After my divorce and in the 2 years where I was really heavy into the addiction, the self-dialogue was not positive.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be driving down in my car to go pick up my kids because I was divorced and they didn't live with me, and that was the only way to get them. And I would say things like this to myself. I hate my life.
Yeah.
And I really did hate my life, but I didn't know how to get out of it, and I didn't know what to do. I can tell you, since I've been sober, it'll be 3 years in September, there'll be times that I'll be like, man, this sucks, but I haven't uttered those words, I hate my life.
Yeah.
Not since the day I got sober.
Good.
I hate certain situations. I hate things that I have to do.
Things outside of you.
Yeah, but I do not hate my life. As a matter of fact, I love my life. And the crazy thing is, when I talk to people, I go, my life right now, even to this day, is 100 times harder than it was.
Yeah.
But it's 1,000 times better.
Yeah.
And so people
have an internal dialogue that reflects their state of mind, if you want to think of it that way. And if you're listening to this show, you need to think about what we call negative automatic thoughts. What are the little quick automatic things you say to yourself about yourself? If they're negative, like I hate my life, I wish I was dead, you know, I'm a loser. If you're having those little things, you need to look at your broader perspective in your life and say, something's got to change.
Mm-hmm.
It probably is an addiction of some sort and other underdeveloped skills that you have. But as soon as you start to live a healthy quality life where you're doing productive things and your mental health is back on track, you're going to notice those don't pop into your head anymore. Instead, it might be a situation like, oh, I don't want to do this, you know, or something like that.
Like picking up dog poop this morning.
That, yeah, every day for me, yeah. And but like your negative thoughts about yourself aren't going to be there. And in fact, they might start getting replaced with thoughts like, I got this, I can do this.
Yeah.
You know, I believe in myself. And so that's a great way to judge your own mental health. Pay attention to your automatic thoughts. Are they more negative or more positive? If they're negative, get some help. Something needs to change.
So it's been a month since my daughter's Presley's letter was read on this podcast.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Over 3.6 million views. We got some love from the Today Show. It's been all over the internet. I get people stopping me at Maverick, at the gym, telling me how much the letter meant to them.
We still have people, you know, commenting on our Facebook about how much they appreciate it.
So I wanted to check in with my kids and kind of see how they were doing because of all of this kind of notoriety and things that came along with it. So I checked in with Presley. I go, how are you doing? She goes, Dad, I'm good. You know, and I think she got a lot of benefit from the letter. She finally got her words out, her thoughts, her feelings. And I think she was along the ride, you know, so I got to see her as we went through it. And then I went and asked my daughter, Frankie. She's my middle child. I go, how are you doing? And she said kind of jokingly, but kind of seriously, do I have to write a letter, Dad?
Oh, that's interesting.
And, you know, I go, well, no, but you can. I mean, if you want to, or we can just talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, because
why did she think? Did she think in order to maybe let you know how she was doing, did she need to write a letter, or was it now sort of an expected thing in the family to write a letter? What did she explain that?
I think it was a little of all of that. And plus, I think she wanted a little attention. Just to be honest with you, a little attention. Here, my oldest child was getting all this attention for something that she went through too. And, you know, everybody was telling her how brave she was. And, you know, Frankie was there too. Bowden was there.
Well,
now,
of course.
Yeah, each of them had a different experience with it. Unfortunately, I think Presley probably had the most stuff that went along with my alcoholism.
Well, she was the oldest, and oldest kids often find themselves in sort of a caretaking role.
Yeah.
So she probably felt not just she was dealing with her own stuff, but she probably, like most oldest children, felt some obligation to protect or buffer the youngers.
Yeah, and she said the
younger
in the letter.
And the younger kids don't have that same feeling because they're just not in that role, and they're not in that position in the family.
So I talked to Frankie, and she goes, Dad, I'd just like some time with you. And I said, well, let's go skiing. So me and her loaded up the car, just me and her, went up to Snow Basin.
Nice.
Had a wonderful day.
Yeah.
And just talked. And so I think, you know, her love language is quality time. So she just wanted some quality time with Dad, so we went and did it.
Well, good for her to ask for what she needed.
I mean,
that's actually a skill in and of itself. Kids need to learn how to ask for what they need. You know?
And then I asked Bowden, I said, Bowden, how are you doing? He goes, Dad, I'm pretty good. He goes, you know, I was a little too young to remember all of that. And I go, yes, son, I know. And so most of the stuff that Bowden remembers, and I'm sure he does remember more than I know, is what his sisters or his mother or his family members have told him about the addiction.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, and so, you know, his stories are a little bit more funny, you know, I remember when you were a drunk, Dad, you know.
He's detached.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when you first got sober, he would announce, if you were walking into the Maverick, he'd announce, this is my dad, and he's not a drunk anymore.
And not on TV either.
And not on TV.
Yeah.
He's also unemployed.
But we're doing so much better. But I want to bring this around because today we're talking more about how addiction is a family disease.
Okay.
Our guest today is Shamra Berry, and she reached out to me on Facebook. She said her siblings, her parents are all addicts.
Oh, wow.
And so she's here to talk about it. So stick around. More Project Recovery. We'll be right back.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. I'm the guy that's just running the board, happened to be an alcoholic and had an idea for a podcast and talked you into coming along.
And you are a radio and television professional. You're good at it, man.
Well, you know what? I've been doing it for 20 years, and I'm glad that I can use my skill to help the world of recovery. We've talked often about how addiction is a family disease. And so I wanted to bring in Shamar Shamra.
Yes.
It's just spelled weird. and I'm not making fun of your name.
No, I know.
But it's Shamra.
It's kind of a unique name. I haven't heard that name before. Is there a story behind
I don't know. If my dad was still alive, I'd be able to ask.
You'd be able to ask, yeah. Okay.
But before we get to talk to her, I want to read you what she sent to me on Facebook. She goes, I know you probably get this a lot, but I absolutely love listening to your podcast. Myself and my four siblings and my biological mom and father are all recovering addicts. That is, I mean, I don't know where to even begin on that. And so when I read that, I was like, this really is a family disease. We need to have this young lady on. And when I met you down in the lobby, you seemed a little nervous.
Yes.
Why are you nervous?
It's more of the fact of other people. I'm more scared of being judged.
Do you think, but look how far you've come.
Yes.
How much sobriety date, what's your sobriety date right now?
Almost 5 years.
So look what you've been through to get here.
Yes.
And I think all the judging would have been prior.
Yeah, but it's more so of the fact, like, people, a lot of people don't know exactly of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just more of, like, more afraid of them thinking, how the hell did you get here?
So then why do this?
Because I do want people to know, like, you can overcome the addiction. You can push through it. But you have to push yourself.
You have to want it more.
Yes.
Than anything else.
Yes.
I think that being what you're doing, I consider brave, because there is a real stigma about being an addict to anything. And pushing through that hesitation and worry about being judged is the only way that stigma starts to go away in our communities, in our society. And so honestly, for 2 years, I've sat here and been impressed with everybody's willingness to come on and talk about their story for the exact reason that you're afraid of. I wonder, gosh, would I come on and talk about it if I had a story like that? Like that takes a lot of courage and bravery to do that, but you're doing yourself a favor. I think it's cathartic and it's great to tell your story and kind of let yourself be authentic with other people. But that starts to, it's like a domino effect. It spreads and other people will take courage and want to share their story as well. And that's how we break down stigmas and start to really treat it like the disease that it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, my story is not so much for me. I know my story. I live my story. My story, and I continue to tell it on anybody's podcast who will ask me, is to, in hopes that somebody out there will hear this and go, wow, if that guy can do it,
yeah,
I can do it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so that's what it's all about. And that's what this podcast is. So thank you for coming on and telling your story. Let's get to your story. Okay. How does it begin?
So I'm from Ogden. I was a crazy kid, I guess. I was raised by my grandma and her husband. I was taken away from my biological mom, the one downstairs, when I was 4. She was addicted to meth, her and my father. And so growing up, I was LDS. I was in the church. I did what a kid needed to. Come third grade, my grandma, my mom, found out we were all being sexually abused by her husband. And I had actually mentioned it to the bishop. I didn't know who else to tell. So he didn't believe us. My sister, she's still currently an addict. She just got released from jail because she's a lost cause pretty much. She had told my mom what was going on. So my mom packed us all up and we had moved out. From there, we were jumping house to house to house.
How many of you are there and where do you fall in that line?
In that house, there is 1, 2, 3, 4 of us. And I had 2 older and 1 younger.
Okay.
We moved in with my Aunt Michelle and we tried to get him like charged with everything. Didn't work. He spent maybe 6 months in prison or jail, I guess, and he faked a heart attack. But from there, we were...
Sorry, that's my phone. It's normally off. I feel so bad.
Did I radio professional? That's what I said earlier, right?
Yeah. Okay. Man, that sucked. Okay, so no worries. I don't want to take you out of it, but he's in jail, faked a heart attack. Where does it go from there?
So we were living with my aunt. I guess he kept trying to get in touch with everybody. My biological mom had found out because she was in jail at the time. She had found out and she had called the house and asked him. And she's like, I knew he was just telling me lies and everything. I just wanted to find out where you guys were. He had told me where you guys were and gave me the phone number. So, but from when I was younger, I don't remember much of what went on. I erased my whole childhood.
Did you know your parents were addicted to drugs?
Yes.
I mean, it was evident.
Oh, yeah. They were very open about it. I was never mad at them. I was the only kid that accepted them. I wanted to see my parents.
Mm-hmm.
All the other siblings, they just did not care. So
at a young age, you knew your parents were addicts. Mm-hmm. You're now living with your grandparents.
Yep. And we moved in with my grandparents. She found out he was sexually abusing all of us.
And it sounds like her husband, you said it that way, so that was not your biological grandfather.
He is.
Oh, he is. Okay.
I don't.
But not in your mind.
Nope.
Okay.
I've never accepted him.
Okay.
But yeah, we move into my aunt's, and that's where everything just kind of like spiraled down. We started acting out. We didn't care about anything. My biological mom actually ended up getting us back, and we moved in with her. My mom went and lived out in Plain City with her sister, moved in with her. Jennifer, my biological mom, she was like an off and on drug user. She would never make it noticeable, but you knew.
Yeah.
Anybody knows the difference. I mean, she was doing great when she got us back. She was a manager at Denny's. She paid for her own stuff. She had her own house, but kept getting back into drugs. And end up going and living with my mom again.
You know, and there's a lot of addicts out there that mm-hmm. go in cycles like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tell people all the time, and you know, when people go, hey, were you an alcoholic the whole time you're on TV? I was like, well, technically, yes, but I'd have good years. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'd go many years where it wasn't a big problem. And then something would happen and 3 or 4 months would get ugly.
Yep.
And then I would get better again. Mm-hmm. I would do that thing where I promised that I was never going to do yep. that again. I won't be an embarrassment. And then I would try to hold true to that. But I wasn't going back and fixing the core reason. That's why I was always slipping back.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like your mom was kind of running that cycle.
Yes. And there was always promise. I promise I'm not going to do this.
But you believe the promise.
Yes.
You want
yes.
to believe the promise.
Of course, she's
and
my
I
mom.
Think the addict means the mm-hmm. promise.
Yep.
They want to.
But it's hard.
Yes.
It's a hard thing to get away with. And I know that. And that's why I loved her unconditionally, her and my dad, no matter what they did. But yeah, she started getting back into that. So we'd move back to my mom's. And then she'd clean up. We'd go back to her. Come sixth grade, we moved back in with her. And, well, I was like 13, turning 13. That's where I started doing all the stuff that, because she wasn't home. She was a manager at night. I didn't have any supervision. So that's when I started drinking. And I tried pot for the first time. And
at 13?
Yeah. Started doing a bunch of stupid stuff.
And do you remember the feeling? Did it feel normal? Did it feel like you were doing something you shouldn't be doing? I mean, what were you looking for when you went to those?
Honestly, I think it was more the fact of, okay, I want somebody to catch me. I want the attention. I want my parents. Because at this time, my dad was back in jail. And it was just her. So we didn't have anybody at the house. So I think I just wanted to be like, catch me. I want you to pay attention.
What was your relationship like in those years with your mom? Biological.
I was still super close with her. She would hang out with us when she had the time. I was always close with her.
Okay.
And then she would slip off again. And so when my dad went back to jail, when I started acting out, she started dating this other guy and whole crap storm.
So you were the third youngest in a family
mm-hmm.
of four,
mm-hmm.
and you tried alcohol and marijuana at the age of 13.
Mm-hmm.
What about your two older siblings? What were they doing at this time?
They're already far gone.
Far gone?
Far gone. Yeah.
How old were they when they started using something? Do you know?
No, I don't remember.
And it's their story, so we don't want to get too much into it. But I mean,
I believe they had already been locked up a couple times by then.
And then you had a younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, was he sober at the time?
Yeah, he was just more of the crazy kid. I can jump off a building. I can do this, and you know, but he hadn't started anything then.
And so, mom's working nights. Mm-hmm. You guys are running wild. Are you going to school at the time?
No, I didn't care because I didn't have that supervision. I didn't have that push. I didn't. So when she would come home, she would go to sleep. I would stay in my basement and I would stay asleep. Or I'd have my friends over, or I'd sneak my boyfriend in, or we'd have drinks downstairs. Or
did the school come calling, wondering where you were?
Yeah, and then she would be like, "Okay, well, I'm going to get on her. I'm going to make sure she's there." She never had that push either. She didn't really care.
Well, it sounds like she was in survival mode too. And for an addict, that's all you're doing is trying mm-hmm. to get to the next day,
yeah.
the next fix, the next bottle, mm-hmm. the next pill, whatever it is. And so you're spinning plates in every yep. direction and just hoping one of them doesn't fall until you get to the next day.
I know even to this day, you've seen her, she tries to have a relationship with all of us. She tried then. She didn't want to fight with us. She didn't want to put us in trouble because then we would hate her. Or, you know what I mean? So she would still take us out to lunch. She would take us shopping. She would take us to do fun things when she had a day off. Other than that, there wasn't time.
So when does it start to get ugly for you? I mean, it sounds ugly already.
So come 14, 15, I was still smoking marijuana at the time. Then I met a guy. And he introduced me to pills. And I thought they felt good. And I had fun. If I didn't have those pills, I went out to the store and I bought NyQuil. I'd fight the pills. Try to stay awake because it made you feel high.
Mm-hmm.
From then...
Was this an older boy?
Yeah.
How old was he?
Well, he was only 2 years older than me.
Okay. That's older boy behavior.
Yes.
You know, usually... Boys at that, they still want to make a good impression, but it's the older boys. And I bring that up for the fact that if there's a parent listening, be concerned about
yes.
the 16-year-olds, the 17-year-olds mm-hmm. that want to hang around with your junior high daughter. They usually don't have a positive agenda.
No.
Yeah.
And he had the little sports car, so I was like, ooh, you know. So we stopped hanging out, and I end up getting pregnant, and I have my daughter. So after that, it was more, okay, well, I got pills after having a baby. So 2 weeks after having my child, I end up going to his house and I end up partying. But instead, we would make limerickies. Instead of the vodka, or instead of the grape soda, it was liquid Lortab.
Mm.
So, and then on top of that, we would take 2-3 more Lortabs. And the crazy thing about it, it was all from his mom. So no matter what, we had ways to getting it.
Did his mom know she was supplying yeah. you guys with?
Mm-hmm. We with used that? To have to drive her around because she was so high. She had a breathalyzer thing in her car. She was either high or she was drunk. We'd have to blow in the thing and we could drive a car.
Wow.
So who's watching your 2-week-old baby at this time?
My biological mom. She finally ends up getting sick and tired of it, and she tells me, she's like, "I'm taking your kid. You're not getting her back until you get clean." And I was like, "You're not taking my kid." Like, no. So she ends up taking her, but ends up going down the road and parking, waiting to see if I actually leave. I honestly don't remember if I left.
How does that make you feel saying that?
Like hell.
Yeah.
Because I love my kids, and they changed me for me. But I ended up going home. I do remember that, and I stayed in there for 3 days, and sick and all, sleeping, and she took care of my child.
So you go home, you decide to detox yourself
mm-hmm.
for 3 days.
Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go to rehab. I was scared.
Why?
To be away from my baby. Or losing my baby. If the state found out, I'm going to lose my kid. I'm going to be just like my biological mom. So I didn't want to leave her.
And you didn't want to be anything like your mom?
Nope. I always told myself growing up, I was never going to be like her. ever. And I turned out just like her, I feel. And I don't... And I sound like such a hypocrite. Like, I always told myself I was never going to be like her, and I'm going to be so much better, and I'm going to take care of my kids, and I'm going to have all my kids. But I was doing the same thing as her.
But that's the power of addiction.
Mm-hmm. I felt good. I wanted to... That's all I knew. Growing up, that's all I knew. I saw parents high, siblings high, cousins high.
So after 3 days of detoxing at home...
I get up. I'm better. I spend time with my baby.
How old are you at this time?
17.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a lot for a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Who has no formal education.
No.
Role models are all addicts.
Mm-hmm. And I was scared. I was terrified to
you
be a mom.
Be.
Like, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't have... The only role model I knew I have was my mom, my grandma. And mm-hmm. she was amazing. But I wanted to party and do other stuff, so I didn't live with my mom anymore. Jennifer, let me do this. My mom didn't.
So after 3 days, you get up, you play with your son, your daughter.
Yeah, I take care of her. I be the mom. He comes back into my picture, and I go again.
The baby daddy.
Oh, ex, yeah.
Yeah.
And I go have fun, and I get back on the pills. And I remember at one point, I broke up with him because he wouldn't give me any pills. I kept asking him, like, can I have some more? Can I have some more? He's like, no. Jennifer will kill me. No, you need to be here for your kid. Give me some pills or get out of my house and we're done. He didn't give me pills. He left. But I kept going back because I knew he'd give me pills. Okay, I'm fine. My back hurts. Or I just had a kid. Like, I hurt. I need some more. Then from there, I stay clean for a little bit. And I have my son. I had him at 19. And I was doing just fine. Up until he was almost 3, I was fine.
Just fine meaning sober?
Yes. And, well, that's his dad that I used to party with. So I go around more, hang out with him. He spends time with his son, so on and so forth. And we get back into it. And instead of trying to figure out what more can get us high, we start doing cocaine. And I remember one night we did it, and I was like, this doesn't feel right. Something's up. And come to find out, it was laced with meth. And my kids are in the freaking house at the same time, but they're sleeping. And I feel like crap saying that. But they're sleeping. And here me and my friends are snorting cocaine, taking shots. And I come to terms, like, I'm being freaking irresponsible. Like, what if my kids walked in on me doing that? Well, what the hell am I doing?
You had that realization at the time?
Yeah.
In, like, the moment?
What was I doing? I was up all night. So me and my friend brewed coffee. And I'm like, what are my children going to think? They're going to wake up and be like, have you been up all night? And then what if I crash during the day? Who's going to watch my kids? I wasn't thinking then, though. All I cared about was the next high.
So after that life epiphany, what did you decide to do?
I started shaping up. I got a job. Spent more time with my family. I started going out to my mom's more. Started seeing my dad more. So rewind. I had a friend, his name was Derek, and I met him when I was in high school before I had any kids. And I would see him a lot. He was in the military, so when he came home, he would come over to my house because we were really close friends. And we ended up getting together because I'm like, well, I've known him for years. And so go a couple months, and I mean, he eventually told me, he's like, you either need to clean your act up and you need to promise me that you're not going to get high again, or I will make sure that me and the kids are gone. And so, you know, I would rather him and my kids. So we ended up getting married and ended up having my youngest, Mackenzie. And then, so while I was pregnant, I was taken care of. So he was stationed in Colorado And we had bought a house out in Harrisville. And it was me, my two kids. I was pregnant and I was taking care of my dad. He was going through chemo. So I, of course, I was clean. I don't even take ibuprofen when I'm pregnant. It scares me. I don't know what's going to happen. So with that, I ended up having to give birth early because me and my daughter, I had only gained 6 pounds during the whole pregnancy. And my daughter stopped gaining weight while she was in my stomach. My dad had passed away July 22nd. And I actually, I found him. I went down to take him some coffee and he had passed. And so that put a lot of stress on me. So I delivered my baby early. And afterwards, I had found out that my ex-husband was having an affair. So I moved back in with my mom out in Plain City. And that's when I start taking pills again. I was like, okay, well, my anxiety is so high. I'm depressed, you know? And a couple of years back, I had went down a water slide and I went backwards. Well, how I landed, instead of like a scorpion, I went this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I had did something to my back. So I went to the doctor and they took x-rays and they're like, yeah, you know, you have a pretty messed up back. So they prescribed me Lortab and Xanax for my stress and my anxiety. And they gave me Adderall. And so from there.
Deadly combination.
Yes. Horrible.
We had another guest on the show and said that was, I mean, for addicts, that was the trinity.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted those three.
Because mm-hmm. it was, if you're feeling too low, you can take one that's upper. You can, you know, make it
you can
level.
Try to level it out.
Yes.
It never really works,
no.
Does it?
Yeah. No. So, yeah, I would take 7-8 pills a day of Lortab. I would take 4-5 Xanax,
wow.
And then my Adderall. But I would always try, okay, well, if I'm too low, I'm gonna take my Adderall.
You must have just been in sort of a fog all
pretty
the
much.
Time, right? Because,
well, it makes,
I mean, that's...
The days sound like a yo-yo, up and down, up and down, up and down.
I wanted to because I, at that point, and I know it sounds like an excuse, but at that point, I hadn't gotten over finding my dad.
Well, let's talk about that.
Taking
I
my
mean,
kids.
It's, so your dad obviously had gotten out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
Or jail, wherever he was, and he had been diagnosed with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And how did it happen? I mean, you didn't have much of a relationship with him, I guess, but how did it happen that he came to be under your care?
So, like Jennifer, I loved my dad unconditionally, no matter what. He came out, and he was actually, the whole time, he had an amazing job. He had a house. He had a car. He bought me a car. He made the payments. That whole time he was all using.
Wow. So a functional addict.
Huh? Yeah. And so when I had got married, he went to the doctor and they're like, oh yeah, you have pneumonia. Well, he went back 2 days later and they're like, you have stage 4 lung cancer. I don't know what's going on.
Wow.
Like, I don't know why they told you had pneumonia because you don't.
Was he a smoker?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So when I had moved into my house, before I moved into my house, I lived by myself, me and my kids. And he had moved in there. And we just loaded all of his stuff up in a big trailer and parked it in my driveway. And so his son, so he has two other sons. So I have two other brothers. One of them passed away when I was 7. He got shot. And then my other brother, he was actually in prison at that time because of drugs when my dad was sick. So I was the only one that can take care of my dad, and I wasn't going to put him on, you know, put him in the hospice or something.
The two older brothers, they were not your, they were half,
yeah,
half brothers.
They were his sons.
They were his sons.
So my dad isn't my biological.
Okay.
I don't know who my biological is. He didn't want anything to do with me. So my dad raised me, and that's who named me and brought me up.
Okay. And was his son who got shot, was that a gang related issue?
I've heard so many different stories. Okay. I heard it was a gang issue. I heard he was playing Russian roulette. Nobody knows.
It sounds like both of those boys were struggling with addiction as well.
Yep. There were times where my biological mom would tell me, oh yeah, we found them and they were so high or they were doing this. And yeah.
Okay.
Everybody.
So just everybody, I mean, just down the line, whether they're directly related or not, it sounds like everyone's struggling with addiction, and addiction's creating these different outcomes for everybody.
Yes.
I'm kind of joking, but a little bit serious. We should put a diagram to go along with this podcast because, I mean, there's so many people that are in and out of your life
yes.
that have been a constant, and it seems like the one constant is most of them are battling some sort of addiction.
Well, if we were doing family therapy,
right?
One of the techniques I think we'd use for you would be to write out a family tree.
Mm-hmm.
And you do the family tree and you make connections like branches based on, you know, the different things that are going on in your relationship with these people. Mm-hmm. One of the constants in that tree would be addiction,
yep.
obviously.
So your father passes away. Mm-hmm. You find him.
Well, tell us about that. I mean, if you don't mind, I know that's hard, but I think that plays a role in your ongoing addiction. I mean, that's traumatic to find your father.
And it seems to be the catalyst to get you back in to the addiction world after doing so well for so long.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I said, I went down to, so the night before, and I remember this, I was playing Xbox and I was like, Dad, come upstairs. And he couldn't even walk upstairs. His throat was so closed. He couldn't even take any medicine. So I asked him to come upstairs and he seemed just fine. Like, oh, you made it up the stairs. You're talking, everything. And he had told me, he's like, hey, I talked to your brother. I was like, I wanted to talk to him. Why didn't you tell me? He's like, no, I talked to Justin. I was like.
And he's the one that passed away.
Yeah, I'm like, how did you talk to Justin, Dad? And he's like, I seen him. And he said that everything is fine up here. I'll be okay. I'm like, what are you talking about? I was like, no, he didn't. No, you didn't, Dad. He goes, no, I swear to God. He said, I'm going to be fine. I know it's going to be hard, but everything is fine up here. I was like, okay, I love you. Go downstairs. Go rest. Do what you need to do.
What did you think at that time, that he was hallucinating or making that up?
I don't know.
Or?
Growing up, I always got told, like, if you're close to death, you can see people on the other side. I've always been told that. So, like, that scared me because I'm like, oh, my God. When is my dad going to pass?
Okay, so you did take him kind of seriously.
Yes.
You're worried.
Yeah. And so he went to bed. Everybody left. I went upstairs when I went to bed. And I swear to God, I could hear my dad walking around my kitchen because my bedroom was next to my kitchen. He was down in his room. And I swear I could hear him. So I'm like, oh, my dad's up here. It's fine. So then the next morning I wake up and I get some coffee. I walk downstairs, go give dad to give him some coffee. I knock on his door and usually you could hear breathing. It's like his breathing. It was like somebody covering your mouth and you're like gasping for air. That's mm-hmm. how it sounded. It was super loud. So I couldn't hear it. And I'm like, maybe he's having a good day. So I knock on the door and I walk in. I was like, hey Dad, do you want some coffee? And how he was sitting on his bed, it seemed like he was just like sitting there, leaning over, relaxing. And there was a book and he had a lighter in his hand. And I was like, Dad, do you want to wake up and have some coffee? Nothing. So I went closer. I was like, Dad. And nothing. So I shook him and I was like, oh my God. So I run out. I call my mom, my grandma, and I was like, Mom, I think Dad's dead. She's like, okay, call 911. I'm on my way. And 911 gets there. I make sure all my babies are upstairs because my daughter had the closest relationship with my dad. He wrote her a song. He left her a letter. They were super close. And I didn't want her to remember that. So I made sure all my kids were upstairs. They came in, they took him out. And I remember I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. People kept telling me, well, you're pregnant. You need to eat. You need to take care of yourself and that baby. And all I wanted to do was just sit and cry by myself. I didn't want anybody helping. Yeah. But yeah, and after that, I was pregnant, so I couldn't, like, deal with it. I had to take care of my baby. After the words, I got all these pills handed to me, and I just wanted to mask everything.
Wow.
That's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to think about it. I hate thinking about stuff. I hate remembering stuff. I hate it. That's why I don't remember any of my childhood, because there's bits and pieces that I remember my childhood, but it's not good ones. I hate remembering what I remember.
And it may be even more complicated than that, especially in childhood. Kids will tend to dissociate. and not be mentally present mm-hmm. during traumatic events as a way of being able to cope, because mm-hmm. as a child, you don't have the power and control over your situation like you might mm-hmm. as an adult. As an adult, we do have power and control over most of our situations, but when we feel that hopelessness or feel overwhelmed, then it's easy to try to, like you said, mask that with a substance of some mm-hmm. kind. And so I can imagine that it was overwhelming to think about the loss of your father and to be the person who found him. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it makes sense, unfortunately, that you would have relied on your skill set from younger years, which is drugs and alcohol, to yeah. get through things.
Yep.
So you're forced to have the baby a little bit early. Mm-hmm. Because the baby's not gaining weight. Mm-mm. How long after the birth of your child do you start using opioids again?
She was almost a year. From there, I would just drink or go out and smoke weed but then I started getting all my pills again. And my mom even told me, because I was living with my mom at the time, she's like, those are going to kill you. You need to stop. I was like, I know, Mom. I'm not addicted. I'm fine. I know I can stop. I would have to carry my purse everywhere. I didn't care what anybody thought. I would take a pill and go drive. I would take pills and drink. Like, when I was younger, I don't know. Like, I remember one time we had done ecstasy. It was me, my little brother, and my ex, and his friend. And we're like, well, let's take ecstasy and see how much marijuana we can smoke. We did that, and one of his friends literally had a seizure, started foaming from the mouth. And after that, I was like, I never touched ecstasy again. But you think that would be like, never touch anything again? No.
Just don't touch that.
Yeah. So I took my pills and had all that, and then I had met my husband now, and...
How old are you at this point?
25, 26.
Because that life up until 25 is a lot.
Yeah.
Three kids, one divorce,
mm-hmm.
A lot of trauma
mm-hmm.
in a short period of time, where, to be honest, 25 is the age where we in the scientific community have decided that that's about when your brain is finally mm-hmm. fully developed, is around age 24 or 25.
Yep.
And so in many ways, you're still neurologically a child who's growing and developing until about that time.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of young adults are still really trying to find their path in life in their early 20s. But you'd lived a pretty intense, traumatic, and tough life already by the time most people are still trying to just kind of figure out a path themselves.
Yep.
So you meet your now husband.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you meet him?
He worked at Rent-A-Center. So, but I met him. He said, I still ask him to this day, I'm like, did you have suspicions? He's like, yeah, but I didn't want to say it. Like, I didn't want, like, if you weren't using, I didn't want to say it.
So he had suspicions that you might be using, mm-hmm. but you guys never had the talk.
No.
Or as the kids say, the DTR. You never defined the relationship.
Yep. Because there would be times I'd make plans with him and I never shut up. Or I would be with him and I wouldn't be there.
Did he know much about your history?
Not really, no.
Much as you felt like sharing?
Yeah. I just got divorced. I have three kids. I'm back at my mom's. And during this time, you know, like, here I am taking my pills and messing myself up. I'm like, my little brother, I get him on it. Stupid. But I don't know. I guess I wanted to share the feeling.
So you started using with your younger brother.
Yes.
And he hadn't prior to that used.
I mean, he'd smoked weed and that, but it would always be like, okay, well, here's my pill. I'm going to give you your pill. When I would take one, I'd give him one.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom eventually found out, and she was livid. And we had stopped, and so both of us, I did my thing, he did his, but he ended up finding stuff otherwhere. other places.
Yeah.
It's not that hard to find.
So I want to get to this part of the letter that you sent me.
Okay.
My wake-up call was before my mom passed.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
So I was, I don't remember how old I was, but I was living by myself, and I had, it was me, my youngest daughter, and my son, and we were just playing outside, and my son's grandma came over, and I was like, I was complaining of a headache, and she's like, well, here, take this. I was like, okay, what is it? She goes, it's Xanax. And it was the bar. And I was like, God, I shouldn't take this, like, I don't want to. And I'm like, maybe, I think I'll be fine. So I take the Xanax, the whole thing, and that was my night. My husband now, he came to my house, and he said, he's like, I walked into the house, Mackenzie, my 1.5-year-old, was sitting next to me on the bed, just sitting there, doing her own little thing. And you had half your body on the bed, and half your body off the bed. And he's like, I would try to wake you up. You had very shallow breathing. He's like, I tried to put something cold on your head, like on your neck, to see if that'll work. And he's like, you weren't waking up. I literally thought you were dead. And so I woke up the next day and I was like, babe, where's Aiden? He goes, Aiden wasn't here when I got here. I was like, Aiden was here. Where's my son? He's like, Aiden was not here when I got here. I was like, oh my God, I've lost my kid. I was like, okay, where's Mackenzie? And he goes, she's in her room. I was like, okay, where's my son? So I call his grandma and I was like, do you please tell me that you have Aiden? She's like, well, yeah, we asked you last night if he can come stay the night. I was like, Vicky, I don't remember any of this. I was like, what was it that I took? She goes, well, I gave you a Xanax. I was like, a regular Xanax? And she goes, no, it was a Xanax bar. I was like, and you took my kid? I don't remember any of this. And so I ended up moving back in with my mom, and I eventually started stopping the pills because I went in for dental work. And they're like, okay, well, I'm going to give you Lortab for the pain. And I was like, well, I already have some from my doctor. I don't think, you know. She goes, yeah, but you're probably used to that, so let's just give you this to help. And I was like, okay. So then when I went back into my doctor's, he's like, okay, well, we have a red flag because it says that you're pretty much pill shopping. I was like, I'm not pill shopping. And he's like, well, did you just get, like, teeth work done recently? I was like, well, yeah. And they gave me Lortab because they said I was probably too used to what I have now. And because I had been on, then he had pushed me up to Percocets. And he's like, well, you're probably just used to it. So here's these, go back to this and you'll be fine. So that, he's like, I can't give you any more pain pills. I was like, okay, that's fine. So I was like, that's going to help me get clean. Stopping what is being prescribed to me every month, I would get 60 a month.
Wow.
And so I had more than enough. And so I'm like, well, stopping that would probably help me get clean. Great, whatever. I don't need them. And so I ended up moving in with my boyfriend, or my husband. And my mom ends up having cancer again. Her cancer came back. And I would have to take her to her appointments. I'd have to take her to her chemo. I would leave work on my lunch break. I would take my lunch and I would take her to her things. And then I would take her home, make sure everything's good. Because at the time, my youngest brother lived with her, but he was working, and she didn't want nurses. So I ended up helping with my mom. And, come December, she ended up being in the hospital, because she had got really bad. And I mean, this time around, we knew my mom wasn't going to make it, which sucks to say, but she was weak. She didn't have a lot of push. And so we were in the hospital, and the day that she went on life support, we were laughing and joking, and she's like, are you clean? I'm like, well, yeah, Trevor helped me get clean, my husband. And she's like, do you promise? I was like, I promise. Do you want to talk to Trevor? Like, I haven't touched anything, Mom. She goes, okay, well, from here on out, promise me you won't touch it again. I'm like, well, I won't. Like, I don't need to. I don't want to, because then I'm just going to go back to tracking down my pills, or, you know what I mean? And she's like, can you just promise me you won't? I was like, okay, I promise. And we were laughing and joking about something. I think we were talking about Ed, her ex-husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, have you heard from him? She's like, no. And she's like, have you? I was like, I actually ran into him. And he tried to tell me, oh yeah, those are my grandkids too. I want to be able to see my grandkids. You lost all that choice. After what you did to me and my siblings and my cousins, you're not coming close to my children. And then literally a couple minutes later, my mom was gasping for air and she got put on life support. And ever since then, I was like, I promised. I don't want my kids growing up how I did, seeing everything that I seen and going through what I had to go through. I don't want my kids to be like, that's all I freaking knew.
So you break the chain.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people would want to know, it sounds like you got sober cold turkey
mm-hmm.
with the support and help of friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
And you're coming up on 5 years of sobriety.
Yep. I won't even take anything. If I get a root canal, they'll prescribe me. I won't take it.
So you know your script.
Mm-hmm.
Do you talk to them about that? Do you let them know
yep.
that you've had a problem with that in
yeah,
the past?
Yeah, I tell them. I'll be like, okay, I want nothing non-narcotic. I was like, I've had problems with opioids in the past. Like, I don't want anything.
And what is their response when you have that conversation with them?
They kind of look at you like shocked that you're even saying it. Like, good for you. But like, I don't know. It's like a blank face. And I remember one nurse, I went into the hospital because I got super sick one time. And she's like, do you need anything for pain? I was like, do you have like ibuprofen? And she's like, well, yeah. I'm like, no opioids. Like, I don't want Lortab. I don't want Percocets. I don't want nothing. She goes, okay. I'm like, well, I used to be addicted to them. And I just don't want them back in my system. She's like, good for you. I was like, thank you.
I think it's becoming more common for that conversation mm-hmm. to happen. I think part of the surprise on some of the medical professionals' faces might just be the lack of experience of having people talk to them that frankly about it. I think more and more people, thanks to community efforts like Know Your Script and others, are doing what you're doing, which is the smart thing to do and the only thing to do, which is to question the prescription and mm-hmm. say no to the prescription if it's been a problem to you. And I think that more and more doctors and nurses are having that conversation regularly, but friends of mine who are in that position professionally have said that just a few years ago that no one ever brought that up to them. So good for you
and
good for people that's becoming more common.
Yeah. Even like I took my kids to the doctor yesterday, for instance. They're like, hey, well, we're going to think about putting Cadence on my oldest on anxiety or depression pills because she has to get a CT scan. She's having really bad migraines. And I look at the doctor, I was like, non-narcotic, right? And he's like, well, yeah. And Caden's like, Mom. I was like, I just have to double check. I don't want you starting out the age that I did. I don't want anything.
That's a great question to have because a lot of people don't know. And there are different types of anti-anxiety and anti-depression yes. pills. They come different. You know, there are different types. We'll just say that. But no one would expect the average person who's not in the medical field to know that mm-hmm. or to know what, you know, so that you did the right thing again.
Like I was on Wellbutrin my whole life.
Explain it to me. What do these pills do? What's their potential for addiction? Yeah. Right.
Like I don't want my kids any bit close to getting something that can ruin their lives pretty much.
So let's talk about the family dynamic before we wrap this up. Where does everyone stand with their addiction right now? In the family tree.
So the only one that is still using is my sister. She had just got released 2 days ago for the umpteenth time.
Released from jail?
Yeah. She was on probation. She got arrested. And they told Jennifer, she's a lost cause. She's a heroin junkie. There's nothing more we can do for her. There's no point in us keeping her in here. So they let her go. Everybody else is clean. My oldest brother, Travis, he's working. He takes care of his family. He bought a house. My brother, Tyler, he's doing really good. He's got a job, taking care of himself. My younger brother is. So it's just my sister. And I don't know where to go with my sister anymore. Like, I don't know how to help her. We've tried helping. She'll call me for money and I don't feel like giving my sister money because I know what you're going to use that money for.
Right.
You want me to buy you food? Okay. Do you want me to buy you like hygiene stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not giving you money. I don't want the phone call. Oh, your sister overdosed.
That's hard, but we've had so many guests on this show, and it's kind of makes common sense that, you know, we know we're feeding the addiction mm-hmm. for the person. So that's a good alternative as a family member to say, I'll take you to the grocery store mm-hmm. and I'll buy you some groceries, but I'm not going to give you cash.
I've had way too many people overdose. My yeah. friend ended up ending his life because he went to rehab so many different times, and he didn't think anything was going to help.
Yeah.
People and so do. He passed away 2.5 years ago.
It's easy to get discouraged. Just out of curiosity, out of your family, it sounds like everyone but your sister is now mm-hmm. living a sober life. Mm-hmm. Did any of them use a formal program or anything to get clean and sober, or did they sort of do like you did?
Gel. They got sober in yeah. gel.
Okay.
And you know what? To be honest with you, it does work. I mean, yeah. for some, it's not the best, but
jail's kind of like one step away from just cold turkey in it yourself, yeah. right? You're just forced into that mm-hmm. cold turkey time. And then I think the rest of it is really on the person if they're able to keep sober after they leave jail.
But people can go from jail to a drug court to mm-hmm. a sober living. I mean, there's so many different ways up a sober mountain.
See, and my sister's done those multiple times.
So what about your kids? What do they think about you in your life right now?
They think I'm really strong.
You are.
I'm very open with my children. All my children know what I'm doing right now. And they asked me what for, and I told them exactly. My oldest daughter, she knows a lot more than my other two.
Mm-hmm.
She knows.
How old is she now?
She's 13. She'll be 14 in July. She knows every little detail.
Smarter than we think, huh?
It's scary. But I want them to know. And like I told her yesterday, I was like, I'm terrified because the addiction runs so bad in my family. I don't want you guys ending up like I did or my siblings. And she told me not too long ago, she goes, Mom, you're kind of like Grey's. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like Grey. She goes, like Grey's Anatomy. I'm like, what about? She goes, you've lost so many people and you've done so much in your life. And she's like, you are still so incredibly strong.
Oh.
I was like, I love you.
And she does.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, your approach in being open and honest and authentic and talking about how what your experience has been and what your family members' experiences have been, that changes. So you think about it, your addiction really kicked in high gear at the same age your daughter is now.
Mm-hmm.
But she's empowered with knowledge and connection mm-hmm. and her ability to come and talk to you because you're open and honest, and she understands from your perspective what the difference between a sober life and an addicted life. And if there's anything that's going to keep her from ever developing an addiction, it's that sort of connection and communication yes. between the two of you. So
I want to be able to talk to her about, or any of my kids, about anything.
Right.
You know, like my nephew, who we're adopting, he knows nothing but, okay, well, Angie is messed up. She's gone. I don't want my kids thinking that about me. I want them to know that they can do what they want to. Like, Cadence is already planning on being a doctor. My son wants to be in the military and he wants to be a gamer. My youngest daughter, she wants to be a doctor also. I didn't have those goals when I was little.
No, I think you, unfortunately, kids who grow up in addicted households, excuse me, are in survival mode. And mm-hmm. I think you were in a survival mode as a 13, 14-year-old and trying to escape the stress and pressure that you were too young and not equipped to handle.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the difference, don't you, between mm-hmm. your kids and how they think and how you thought at that age. They're not in survival mode. They feel loved and supported, and they have a mom who talks to them straight and honestly, and they have, sounds to me, like a stable household. And that's when dreams flourish. That's when kids do mm-hmm. start to believe in themselves, and they think, I could be a doctor, I could be, you know, whatever. And that's an amazing difference. That's so measurable, just the difference between how you thought and felt at that age and how your kids are thinking and feeling at this age. That's an impressive generational progression that's just invaluable to see from one generation to the next. What a monumental leap you've been able to make because of staying sober.
Mm-hmm.
Before we let you go, tell me about this wonderful husband.
Oh, he's amazing. No, he really is. He took my kids in like they were his own. My oldest daughter actually wanted him to adopt her. But things kind of got in the way. But no, his name is Trevor. He has two other kids, Lexi and Trey. Amazing kids. He's a very hard worker. He's actually possibly maybe taking a company. Good for him. I'm proud of him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I couldn't thank him enough for everything he's done for me and my children. I don't know where I'd be. I'm pretty sure I'd be like my sister right now.
You know, I just thought of something, and sometimes these work out for me and sometimes they don't. But addiction is a family disease.
Yes.
But so is recovery.
Yes.
You know, recovery is something that the family needs to do. And it seems like your family is proof of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone has done it, but everybody's given it their best. And, you know, that's the thing about addiction. Not everybody's going to win as much as we want to.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to be able to help everybody. It's not going to happen.
No.
And that breaks my heart.
Yes. Because you can do it.
Yeah.
It's hard, but you can.
But I am so impressed by your vulnerability, your willingness to come and share this, and your raw strength and determination to break this habit and break the chain. Because I think that's exactly what you're doing in your family. You're, because of the stuff that you've gone through, because of the battles you have fought, your kids' lives are going to be so much better. Your kids are warriors right now, mm-hmm. for the fact of everything they've gone through.
Yes.
But you are making a difference, and I think you are breaking that chain. And I don't know if you know what a big deal that is, but it's huge. And so congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, it's just to my final thoughts, I guess, on all of this is it's really interesting to see when we talk about it being a family disease, there's nature and nurture. You know, there's biological, genetic predispositions that we inherit from our family. And then there's what we observe, the environment that we're raised in, what's available to us, what we're taught, how do you deal with stress? Well, you take a pill or you smoke something or you drink something. You know, those are the environment. We can't control the biology, biologically, genetically, we are who we are,
mm-hmm.
but we can control what happens in our environment. And by you taking control of that, like Casey said, it's just changed in one generation, you've started to change the destiny, so to speak, of your children. They got the biology they've got,
mm-hmm.
but we can also control the environment. And by controlling it in a healthy way, sky's the limit.
Yes. Like, trust me, they get frustrated.
Oh, yeah.
I don't let them go out of the house. I don't trust them.
You know all the tricks.
Do you want to go to your friends? Yeah, Mom. No, I don't know her dad. And it's the dads. Like, it terrifies me. Oh, like I told my daughter the other day, she's like, I'm not you. I know I'm 13. I'm not you. I know, Cadence, you're not. But still, like, I'm going to push you. I was never pushed. Me and my husband are like, you get good grades, you need to be successful in life. Because look at us. We're not. Like, I'm 31 almost, and I'm doing my medical assistant finally. You know what I mean? Like, I want my kids to graduate college, go to college, go around the world for a year before college. Do you. Don't do what we did. And I'm going to continue to push them.
I think you're doing wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
31 seems young enough to me. That's right. Pretty good.
Yeah. I'm 47 starting over.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you for listening to Project Recovery. It's brought to you by our friends at knowyourscript.org. Shamra's story is an amazing story. We thank everybody who reaches out to us on Facebook, Instagram, and all of our social. Keep sending us great guests. We'll keep putting them on and doing what we do. Don't forget, Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope in Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.